That building you're looking at is called the Azadi Tower. In Farsi, what it means is the Freedom Tower. It's an important place right now here in Iran. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we are coming to you tonight from Tehran, the capital of Iran. It's tense here, and people are dealing with many things, both, as we know, from an international perspective, as well as from a domestic standpoint. International is obvious. The United States is threatening Iran. Iran is threatening back with retaliatory measures of their own. And while the world is looking at that, here in Tehran, there's almost a bigger story. And it has to do with the economy. And in many ways, it has to do as well with what is the situation with their currency right now. The numbers, I have to tell you, are staggering. And I'm going to share them with you. The currency here is called the Iranian rial, right? A rial. Right now, in this country, right, you need 1,200,000 rials to equal $1. That's inflation. That's inflation as high as anyone's ever heard anywhere. But that's the situation that the people here in Tehran are dealing with. So when you hear of protests, And when you hear that there are people here who are upset, that's why. And the government knows this. And look, we didn't come here to do public relations. We came here to do journalism. So we're asking the questions, the tough questions, about what the government is doing about the economic situation here. And they've been fairly transparent. In fact, let me show you something. Let me share with you this part of this conversation I had with a gentleman who is an advisor to the president of Iran. And I asked him quite specifically about the government situation, accusations of corruption in the government, and all the things that are essentially surrounding this very difficult situation that the people are going through. And the people will have come up to me and told me that they're angry about this. Of course they are. Anybody would be in this situation. So here's my conversation with the advisor to the president. Listen to what he says.
First of all, Mr. Pezeshkian has courageously initiated a series of economic reforms over the past year to address various issues, among which are the imbalances in the energy and water and electricity sectors, and they will take time to resolve. But anyway, there has been progress towards resolving them. The government in Iran was offering the dollar at a lower rate, which resulted in a lot of privileges and corruption. This issue was also brought under control about a month ago, so as to prevent this corruption.
You mentioned corruption, so let me ask you about corruption. First of all, don't take this the wrong way, because I understand corruption is everywhere. There's corruption in Russia, there's corruption in the United States. There's been corruption since millennia, of all kinds. However, Iran is in a very sensitive time. And when I talk to the people of Iran on your sidewalks, they tell me corruption, corruption, corruption. They feel like because there's so few items coming into Iran, let's take rice, for example. Rice comes from Pakistan. You get it at a good price, negotiated by the government. But by the time it gets to one family, it goes through this person, that person, that person, and they all take a little bit. And take a little bit. By the time it gets to the average Iranian, it costs too much. I don't mean to tell you I'm a tourist, I'm a journalist from another country, but I feel like the people perceive that. I don't know if it's true, but that's what people perceive. Do they have a good argument?
Yes, that is absolutely true. But the government is trying to eliminate the middlemen as much as it can and demonopolize this trade so that the goods that are going to be imported can be imported at a much more reasonable price and become available to the people. A number of goods are totally imported ones, while for some others, only their raw materials are imported. The government is helping promote privatization, and the new government is completely in favor of this. For instance, Iran's largest car manufacturer was handed over to the private sector this time last year. While there were other institutions that wanted to resist, both the government and the leadership supported the private sector running this industry. These are all steps that can be taken to prevent systematic corruption. Regarding other cases, I must say that there is always some corruption in government, which is natural. This issue is also seen in other countries.
So do the people have a right to protest over the economy? Yes. But in January, government officials say they went beyond protesting, beyond anger. You're looking at video we were able to acquire of a volunteer policeman who was stabbed, battered, beaten. You see it here in these pictures, then reportedly partially dismembered and torched. He's reportedly one of 800 police officials or militia volunteers who were killed by protesters. His name was Mohsen Ajizadeh. His widow, sister, and brother, still mourning his loss, invited me into their home. And they described to me the horrific events that killed Mohsen. And while blaming protesters and rioters for what they did to their brother and husband, they also blame those who they say instigated their actions.
I know this is a very, very difficult time for you, and we very much appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Thank you very much. When did you learn, and how did you learn? Take me through the moment when you found out that Mohsen had died.
Almost half an hour before my husband was murdered, I called him on the phone. I asked Mohsen how he was and how he was doing. He said, "I'm at the square," and he said that the protesters are armed. But we're not armed. We do not carry any weapons. And for a moment, I got very concerned because Mohsen had heart issues, a heart condition. And constantly during these years, I've been concerned about his heart condition because I knew that he had previously had a heart attack. Half of his heart was not working. I told him during the phone call, "Mohsen, please return. Please come back home."
So you wanted him to leave that area and come back home, get away from the protesters. That was your advice to him.
Yes, because I was very concerned, yes. After 2 hours, they called me and said that your husband is in a very bad state and he's in a coma and to pray for him. I was stunned. I grew very concerned, but I still had hope. I didn't know that such a disaster had happened. Then I felt terrible. I could not sleep thinking through all the memories with him and his words. I was in a terrible state. And when I arrived in Tehran later, they described to me how it happened. And then the films recorded by CCTV showed how he was murdered. When I saw that, it happened in such a terrible way. What did he do? What did he do to the people that he deserved to be killed in such an awful way? He was hit with pistols and in his side with knives. He was not carrying any weapons. He always told me that safety and the security of people was more important to him. He always cracked a joke and kind of tried to make me happy or relieve my concerns. He was very kind and he had good manners. He told me that he had a task, finding collaborators' houses and drones. He rarely was at home.
Sounds like he was a very committed person, committed to his country. How do you understand that he died? Who killed him and how did they kill him? Before we even talk about why, I want to understand how he died. Do you know?
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I express my gratitude and hello to you. The question of who murdered my brother can be answered by saying that it was the power of imperialists, the hegemony system, and the media, which was supported with dollars, so that it could easily deceive, with all its demands, the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Such demands exist in other countries. There is no country in the world in which people demand nothing from their government. But unfortunately, the hegemonic system is against our country and its righteous people. What they organized in our country ended in the death of 3,117 people, as stated by state media. My brother was establishing discourse and dialogues with people. He was not a military person. He was living an ordinary life. He was busy in different companies. He was an accountant. He was trying to make people aware, to let them know that the reality and what you're being told are quite different from what foreign media is telling you. And what is going on inside the country is quite different. He explained the progress made by the Islamic Republic of Iran and what progress we have achieved after the Shah regime. And it was the Americans that stopped the country from progressing. He was trying to tell the truth to the people, not the truth that is based on the fantasies of certain people, but the reality, which was tangible. That was why he was martyred, because the discourse of those who are right is definitely not accepted in the hegemony.
So he was martyred by Iranians who you believe were inspired to hate and to kill by what was put in their head by foreign governments and by the conditions created in this country by foreign governments. Did I get that right?
Yes, to what you are saying, that he was martyred by Iranians who were influenced and so on. This kind of action is inhumane. You don't see such brutal actions in animals either. Unfortunately, there are foreign mercenaries in this nation, American mercenaries. Mossad intelligence has been active in this country alongside the demands of the people. We actually need to make a distinction between people and rioters. People have demands, but those who start riots should not be categorized as people.
But there is an anger in the country about the economy. That seems to me, from all your fellow citizens that I've spoken to be legitimate. That doesn't mean they have a right to be violent, but they do have a right to be angry about their living conditions. Do you agree?
When the hegemony system sanctions us, the same hegemonic system stirs people up to go make demands. So there is a contradiction here. You cannot sanction my assets and tell my children to go and claim and demand. On the one hand, they are confiscating or sanctioning the Iranian assets outside the country. And on the other side, they instigate people to go and make their economic claims.
So you're saying they were led to hate by sanctions, which made them hungry, and information, which turned their hunger and their anger to violence. You feel like that came from outside of Iran, even though the perpetrators were Iranians themselves, correct?
The organization was definitely planned outside the country. I would say that the management was done outside the country, but it was done exactly at a time when people had claims and were pursuing claims, and they were trying to get some results. So they were opportunists, and they kind of diverted the claims of people in another direction. All the people who are rioters, I don't think they exceeded 100,000 people, but on the 22nd of this year, millions of people came into the streets in support of the rightfulness of the Islamic Republic. And it was broadcast in all media.
I saw it, and it was special. Fresh Tech, tell me, let me ask you a question. Tell me about your brother, and how much do you miss him?
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I have to say that when I was 10 years old, I lost my father. Mohsen was both my brother and played the role of my father. I am the youngest child of the family. When I lost my father, I was just a young kid, and I didn't notice much. But now I feel I have both lost my brother and my father. This is so sad to me. I need to add one point. I believe martyrdom is quite different from natural death. As God in the Holy Quran has said, the martyrs are alive. I was feeling the absence of my parents, since both of them are dead, and now I am really feeling their loss. But I do not feel like I lost my brother, because I believe martyrs are alive. As martyr and commander Qasem Soleimani said several times, you should live like a martyr to become a martyr in the end. I have to say that my brother lived like a martyr, and when he was alive, we had not noticed it yet. We believed him to be a very ordinary person.
like a brother. But after his martyrdom, his friends told us memories. His colleagues and relatives told us things we were totally unaware of. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I have to say that when I was 10 years old, I lost my father. Mohsen was both my brother and played the role of my father. I am the youngest child of the family. When I lost my father, I was just a young kid, and I didn't notice much. But now I feel I have both lost my brother and my father. This is so sad to me. I need to add one point. I believe martyrdom is quite different from natural death. As God in the Holy Quran has said, the martyrs are alive. I was feeling the absence of my parents, since both of them are dead. And now I am really feeling their loss. But I do not feel like I lost my brother, because I believe martyrs are alive. As martyr and commander Qasem Soleimani said several times, you should live like a martyr to become a martyr in the end. I have to say that my brother lived like a martyr, and when he was alive, we had not noticed it yet. We believed him to be a very ordinary person, like a brother. But after his martyrdom, his friends told us memories. His colleagues and relatives told us things we were totally unaware of.
They said that to you. The person said that to you on the phone. What? So one of his murderers talked to you?
No, my brother's friend called him, and somebody picked up the phone and said that they have killed my brother.
So, but one of the murderers picked up the phone and admitted to killing your brother? Wow.
Yes.
That's...
The body of my brother was not found. Our relatives went together to find him, and they did not find him until 4 or 5 a.m. That's because of what happened at the door of the morgue and the rioters. Most of the agents were trained and were standing and rioting at the door of the morgue. So it was very difficult to find the bodies of the martyrs, and unfortunately, we didn't find the body on Friday. I told my husband that I would accompany him to the cemetery and the morgue.
What did you see? What did you see?
This is the memory I'm going to share with you. I am a media person, just like you. Media people hear something or maybe see clips or films, but what I am telling you is what I have seen with my own eyes. I went there, and in one of the halls where bodies were laid, I went there to find the body of my brother. And what I saw with my own eyes is undeniable, and I cannot accept that Iran, International, and the BBC media are feeding lies to the people of the world. The truth is what I saw. I opened the body bag covers and looked at them one by one and saw that innocent people were killed. Some people were shot from behind in the back, a lot of them. Some of them were shot from a close distance, a lot of them. People were killed with knives or cleavers and became martyrs. Some media says that military personnel shot people. That is not true at all. I was there, and even police forces, Red Crescent workers, and emergency services people were martyred in a very terrible way. Legs and hands were dismembered. Israel and the U.S. made a major effort throughout these years and spent a lot of dollars and used media, but they need to know that the Iranian people will not be affected by such things.
So what you blame the United States? And you blame Israel for creating these conditions, and I understand that. What do you think your government should do to Israel and to the United States? Please.
Please, I want to say that we have been, and we are certain that the United States and Israel are trying to instigate something, and they have a lot of plans for us. We won't get tired. We are a resilient people and nation. In media, Mossad has said that on the streets of Tehran, they were together with the rioters. The United States and American politicians ignore that and blame it on us. I want to say that whatever they think they want to do, they can try. As Imam Khomeini said, the United States cannot do a damn thing to us.
This is a very important question, and I have to ask it. Do you hold your government in any way culpable, even if not intentional, for the conditions that brought about the death of your loved one? Is there anything they could have done differently?
The government is elected by the people. This is the government which was chosen by the people through elections. The Islamic government does everything it can for the welfare of the people, and it is the government which is elected through the direct votes of the citizens. It is not a puppet government ruled from abroad. They are strong people. They are living together. And if the economic system is in a bad situation, it is only because imperialist power doesn't want a prosperous Iran.
If your husband and brother were here today, standing right here with us, what would you say to him?
I would tell him I miss him a lot. We miss you so much. But the right and just path you are taking cannot be wrong. I congratulate my brother on fulfilling his wish. He was fighting for the safety of the people. People in Iran will never forget him and will continue his path.
What would you say to your husband?
If my husband were here, I would tell him, Mohsen, you fulfilled the wish you have, that you always had, which was the path of martyrdom. Congratulations to you. But for me, who has lived 32 years with you, it is very difficult not to have you by my side. Mohsen was a family man. He was very kind. He had a kind heart. He was generous, and it is very difficult for me to go on now that I do not have him by my side. On the other hand, I believe that he has reached whatever he wished for. I ask Almighty God to give me enough patience to be able to be patient like Zainab, the granddaughter of the Prophet.
I want to thank you for sharing your story with us. And once again, I offer my condolences. And I hope that your husband, brother, is right now in a place where he can fulfill all the things that he wanted for you, for his family, and for his country. Thank you once again. I very much appreciate it.
I want you as a media person to show the right path for the people. This right path is not related to religions. It doesn't relate to whether you are Muslim or Jew or Christian. It has to do with humanity. Thank you.
Thank you. It's why we're here. And I want you to know that I think it's important to be here to tell your story. And I am here to tell the story of the Iranian people, because too often the media does not tell the Iranian story. It stops short of telling the Iranian story. And I always say this is about people. It's not about governments. It's not about leaders. It's about people like us. You, me, our families, our children, our mothers, our brothers. And I think if we can create a place where we can talk in those realms in that way, we can improve the situation for Iran and for all the people, and hopefully get Americans, my people, I'm American, to better understand the Iranian people. So I understand your request, and I take it as a serious task, and I'll move forward. Thank you.
One of the things that's obviously very important is that Iran has, as I said earlier, retaliated to the United States threat by saying, if you hit us, this is what Iran is saying, if you hit us, we're going to hit every single U.S. base in this area. And what he's basically talking about is, you know, the U.S. bases. In fact, look at this graphic. Look at this graphic. There's a lot of U.S. bases in that region, especially around the Gulf states. Look at Oman. Look at Saudi Arabia. Look at the UAE. Look at Qatar. I mean, and Iran is saying that's where they're going to retaliate, which is why now many of the countries in this region are saying to the United States, we don't want you hitting Iran from our territory. In fact, the Saudis have come out and said, we don't want you to do that because it'll create big problems for us. Well, Mr. Trump has now responded by essentially saying, we don't even need to do that. We have ways, if we decide to hit Iran, to do it without having to use our military installations, our bases, and our airstrips in these countries. Here's what Mr. Trump says.
We use this one base here, and we're hundreds of miles away. And by the time the planes get to the target, they have to come back and refuel, and we're too far. I said, why do we do that? Because we don't want to offend any of the other countries. I said, we have a lot of portable airports, right, Pete? We have portable airports all over the Middle East, runways that are portable. You put them down, you take them up. We have equipment. Nobody has the stuff we have. And we've got many of them, sir. We have to use them. I said, why don't we? Because we didn't want to offend another country. I said, let me ask you a question. You're in the middle of the desert. Would another country know if we're taking off from some strip in the desert? They would have no idea, sir. They don't have radar. They don't have anything.
So the Saudis are essentially saying, we don't want you to use our airspace to hit Iran. The president is saying, look, we don't need to use your airspace to hit Iran. We have other ways of doing it. Speaking of the Saudis, during my interview yesterday with a former Revolutionary Guard commander, he said the Saudis already have nuclear weapons as a response to one of my questions. To be fair, we have reached out to the Saudi government to make sure they can respond to this, and we're in contact with them and are expecting a response from them. Meanwhile, I should say, in fairness, that the Saudis are signatories of the non-proliferation agreement signed by Middle Eastern countries, saying they are against having nuclear weapons in this region. Now, by the way, the commander for the Revolutionary Guard is not the only person who has accused or said that the Saudis already have nuclear weapons. There's a former CIA official who said the very same thing, and I want you to listen to it. Here it is.
Saudi Arabia, they certainly have more money than anybody in the Middle East. Are you concerned about the possibility they may get a nuclear bomb?
Saudis already have the bomb. But people fail to remember.
Hold on a second, Mr. Clare. Let me just emphasize that point, because that's an important point. You say Saudi Arabia already has a nuclear bomb?
Or several. People forget that it was the Saudis who financed the Pakistani bomb. They put billions of dollars into that effort to create that nuclear capability. And in return, of course, they got something. Now, people can argue whether it was dibs on four nuclear devices or seven. That's the argument. But no one really in the know argues that they do have access to nuclear weapons.
Yay! What is your name?
My name is Farsa Sherbet.
Yay! Boom! What is your name?
What?
Get out of here. What is it? Mohammed. Miami. Miami's in the United States, America.
America.
Yay! Yay! You like America?
Yes.
Hi.
Good pizza in America. You're in Indonesia?
Welcome to Iran.
Thank you. That's so
hello.
Nice.
What? How are you?
Hello.
What's your name? What's your name?
My name is Richard.
Hello. Hello, Richard.
Richard.
Nadani.
What is your name?
My name is Leila.
Nadani. Oh, that's a beautiful.
Nice to meet you.
Bye-bye. Miami, United States. I love you guys. Go Iran.
Nice to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you. Wow, what a conversation, right? That's the importance of being here. You know, what you realize when you come to a place like this is that we're all the same. These are children on their way to school. And they were so excited that I was from America and that I'm from Miami. And they wanted to ask questions and they wanted to tell their stories. And they wanted to tell me about Iran. And they wanted to shake my hand and high five me. And you know, it reminds us that oftentimes the dilemmas and the controversies and the negotiations and that are happening between countries like the United States and Iran, all those things aside, when it comes down to it, it's all about people. It's about the people of Iran, who have nothing against the people of the United States. They've told me this time and time again, and there is no difference. And you feel it, and that's why we're here, because it's so important to be able to tell these stories and to talk to these people and make a story more than just a conversations between governments and institutions. No, we should get back to conversations between the peoples of our countries. I think that's what we ought to do, and I think that's what we try to do with the type of journalism that we're doing by being here in this country. By the way, I mentioned a little while ago the situation between the Saudis and why they're now saying they don't have nuclear weapons. To be clear, I didn't begin this conversation, and it actually began with the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, when he recently said in a speech or in a statement he made why it is that it's important to make sure that the Iranians do not have nuclear weapons. He's the one who mentioned Saudi Arabia. In fact, here it is.
What happens when the same people who are shooting up a mall or driving airplanes into buildings have a nuclear weapon? That is unacceptable. And it's not just them, because if the Iranians get a nuclear weapon, you know who gets a nuclear weapon like the next day? The Saudi Arabians.
Ali Asghar Shafian is a media advisor to the president of Iran. He's an experienced journalist who seems transparent about negotiations and the present conditions in Iran.
Mr. Shafian, thank you so much. This is so nice for you to give us this time.
I'm very grateful.
You are a respected journalist, and you are an advisor to the president of Iran, Mr. Pezeshkian. He just put out a statement a little while ago where he says, Iran is ready to negotiate in good faith, but we will not respond to threats. We will not be threatened. He keeps saying this. Why is he making this point so fervently?
Well, for more than two decades, Iran has been negotiating with other countries, and in fact with great powers, on issues that it has had. And these negotiations are a continuation of the same negotiations. About 10 or 12 years ago, these negotiations became very serious, and they were about nuclear activity. And they led to the JCPOA agreement, an agreement that later fell apart. Now we are facing a challenge, both we and the United States. We have been facing sanctions that have been building up for more than four decades over nuclear activity.
I just want to make sure our viewers all over the world understand where we are. Iran says no sanctions. Please get rid of the sanctions. They're hurting our people. The United States says, okay, but only if you promise not to enrich enough uranium to make a nuclear weapon. Very simple agreement. If the United States lifts sanctions, is Iran willing to do that?
I have nothing to do with this issue that was mentioned. That is a decree by the Supreme Leader. We have previously announced that we do not seek to develop weapons. Now, Iran is fully prepared to relieve the West and the East's concerns about nuclear weapons. Whatever they want, we are ready to provide guarantees and not pursue nuclear weapons. But the other side should also know that we should be able to live a dignified life. The sanctions are very heavy, and they have hurt the Iranian people. So we definitely want to get something in return for what we give. We have no problem or obstacle in this regard.
Well, let's talk about other impediments then. If the deal is clean, no sanctions, Iran stops enriching uranium. Perfect. But the United States is saying, no, we want more. We want no ballistic missiles. And we want Iran to not have relationships or assist in any way the groups that are antagonistic to Israel. And it sounds like the president is saying, you're an advisor to the president, no, no, no. We talk only about uranium. We're not here to negotiate those other terms. Is that the final position for Iran?
Of course, regarding nuclear activities, Iran is not satisfied with zero enrichment. Anyway, Iran wants to negotiate and have a percentage of enrichment which it needs for other activities in other areas. But we are ready for this issue to be set in a form, or accompanied by monitoring, in such a way that will make other nations sure we will not develop weapons, be it the U.S. or any other country willing to treat with Iran on a nuclear issue, and reach an agreement and lift sanctions accordingly. Iran can talk to them on other issues, although, for example, not having relations with other countries in the region is not logical. For instance, we have been accused on many occasions of supporting or even providing moral support to some countries or some groups, including Palestine.
What about the ballistic missile issue? Mr. Trump is saying he wants Iran to give up some of its long-range ballistic missiles. Is Iran willing to do that? It sounds like the president and Mr. Arachi are saying no.
Regarding missiles, Iran will not have any negotiations and will not enter into talks. Missiles ensure Iran's safety. Just as a few months ago, although we did not have airplanes and could not defend ourselves in that way, missiles were the things that were able to keep us standing on our feet.
It sounds like the position of Iran and the United States is moving positively. Both sides, the United States and Iran, says the first discussions were good. But there's news today. Mr. Netanyahu is now saying, after hearing that the negotiations were going well, it sounds like he's not satisfied with that news. He wants to fly to Washington. He's going to meet with Mr. Trump and tell Mr. Trump, probably, no. Iran has to negotiate not just the uranium enrichment. Iran also has to negotiate on ballistic missiles, and Iran also has to negotiate and be willing to stop supporting groups that are antagonistic to Israel. What do you make of Mr. Netanyahu's sudden reaction?
Iran will not pose any threat to anyone outside its territory and has not and will not have any plans to attack or invade any area outside its borders. Of course, just as Iran was attacked in the 12-day war, in such a situation, Iran will immediately respond to any country that invades it. That is why we must have weapons and missiles. There is almost no disagreement in the country about missiles.
Does it bother you that Mr. Netanyahu is inserting himself in these negotiations?
No, this is completely natural. They already had this view of Iran, that Iran wants to destroy something beyond its borders. Well, Iran, even regarding the Palestinian issue, has always stated that it supports eventually holding a referendum in Palestine. To that extent, and no further. Iran has never taken military action against Israel, except in self-defense during the 12-day war, when it was the target of very violent aggression.
There is a feeling in America, for the first time in my lifetime, as a citizen of America and as an American journalist, where I see the American people, as well as American newsmakers and people involved in the national conversation of America, people like Cenk Uygur on the left, people like Tucker Carlson on the right, who are all saying, why do we as America take orders from Israel? Why does Israel tell us what to do? Why do we have to fight wars for Israel? Why do we have to be at war with Iran simply because Israel wants us to? This is a real conversation that's taking place right now in the United States of America. And as Americans are seeing this, Mr. Netanyahu flies to Washington to tell Trump seemingly what to do. What do you make of this development?
Well, it is up to the American people whether they want to be influenced by the demands or pressure of other countries or other people, including Netanyahu. I just have to remind you that a part of the American people that you are referring to are Iranians. These Iranians do not feel good about Iran being violated and assaulted at all. They even object to the sanctions that are hurting the Iranian people.
Let's talk about those sanctions. Because it seems to me the people of Iran, who are good people historically, and What a wonderful culture. And I have found since I've been here that the Iranian people are very embracing and very kind. Even though I'm American, I haven't heard anybody come up to me and say death to America yet. So, but I feel bad for Iranians because they're suffering. The economy here is tough. The currency has gone from 80,000 compared to the dollar to now like 160,000 compared to the dollar. That's hard for a family to be able to feed their children and take care of their kids. What is the government, what is the president doing to solve that problem? Without blaming America or blaming anybody else, what can the government do for its people to help them get out of that malaise?
Well, first of all, Mr. Pezeshkian has courageously initiated a series of economic reforms over the past year to address various issues, among which are the imbalances in the energy and water and electricity sectors, and they will take time to resolve. But anyway, there has been progress towards resolving them. The government in Iran was offering the dollar at a lower rate, which resulted in a lot of privileges and corruption. This issue was also brought under control about a month ago, so as to prevent this corruption. Other economic reforms are also being pursued, but these measures are not enough by any means. We have no other solution than to resolve our issues with other countries, especially with Western countries and the United States. Even in order to have good relations with Russia and China, we need to resolve the sanctions and our problems with the West. Therefore, we are aware of this issue in Iran, that we need to resolve the issues related to the outside world. To address this, Iran is also willing to make deals. Given that the West is concerned about Iran's nuclear activities and has differences with Iran regarding the region, I must announce that Iran is willing to reach an agreement with the United States on these issues. This is a very serious subject, and Iran is very serious about it.
You mentioned corruption, so let me ask you about corruption. First of all, don't take this the wrong way, because I understand corruption is everywhere. There's corruption in Russia. There's corruption in the United States. There's been corruption since millennia of all kinds. However, Iran is in a very sensitive time. And when I talk to the people of Iran on your sidewalks, they tell me corruption, corruption, corruption. They feel like because there's so few items coming into Iran, let's take rice, for example. Rice comes from Pakistan. You get it at a good price, negotiated by the government. But by the time it gets to one family, it goes through this person, that person, that person, and they all take a little bit. By the time it gets to the average Iranian, it costs too much. I don't mean to tell you I'm a tourist, I'm a journalist from another country, but I feel like the people perceive that. I don't know if it's true, but that's what people perceive. Do they have a good argument?
Yes, that is absolutely true. But the government is trying to eliminate the middlemen as much as it can and demonopolize this trade so that the goods that are going to be imported can be imported at a much more reasonable price and become available to the people. A number of goods are totally imported ones. Well, for some others, only their raw materials are imported. The government is helping promote privatization, and the new government is completely in favor of this. For instance, Iran's largest car manufacturer was handed over to the private sector this time last year. While there were other institutions that wanted to resist, both the government and the leadership supported the private sector running this industry. These are all steps that can be taken to prevent systematic corruption. Regarding other cases, I must say that there is always some corruption in government, which is natural. This issue is also seen in other countries.
So, what I hear you saying is that the president's office and his government understands that this is happening and they want to attack it. Have they expressed that to the people? Do the people feel confident that they will do that?
Even in the case of the events of December 2025, one interpretation is that these events took place because the privileges that were given to some people because of the rate of the dollar were stopped. The privileges that led them to sell goods at market prices. We believe that when this was prevented, a part of the protests were initiated by those whose interests were at stake. Of course, I don't mean to say that all the protests were because of this, because anyway, some people had protests for various reasons. Maybe this became an excuse for those protests to be raised as well.
Well, we do know that the United States Treasury Secretary, Mr. Bessent, has bragged about affecting the currency. He said the United States manipulated the Iranian currency so as to create protests in the streets. And he said, look, we did a great thing. We got the people angry at their government. So, and governments do this all the time. We know my country interferes in other countries. But again, it's obviously not an excuse. Do the Iranian people feel, does the president believe that Israel and the CIA, the Mossad, the CIA, MI6, are currently interfering in Iran, with the protests in particular?
They must have played a role in this, but a lot of the protests were reasonable protests by the people. It was quite organic, be it about freedom or political, social, and economic issues. All these protests have sometimes manifested themselves in the form of very large-scale demonstrations in previous years. This is not strange, but surely Israel, which precisely attacked Commander's bedroom a few months ago, must have access to people in Iran through whom it intervened in the protest. But this is not a widespread issue, and I can't say the large number of people who participated in the demonstrations were agents.
They were agents. Some were agents, you think?
Yes, certainly some of them were agents, but let's consider the public sphere. We must also consider the issues that have been stated very clearly. When Trump explicitly stated, go and take over the government buildings and I will come and support you, a section of the protesters probably counted on this. If you're up on a ladder and you're about to fall and someone says, come on, don't worry, I'll catch you, you're probably going to let yourself fall, right? That had a big impact. By the way, we have someone in the opposition now, Reza Pahlavi, who is the son of the last Shah of Iran. He's been particularly supported by Israel. He's been very vocal about his calls to get protesters out on the streets, and he believes that blood must be shed. In fact, the Western media is also supporting this. The American-backed media and the Israeli-backed media and media close to them are all supporting this. In that sense, they're very openly interfering in Iran, and they're, in a way, abusing protesters. Of course, the United States has shown in the past that it has, on many occasions, abused protesters in other countries, or has failed to support them. In the end, the U.S. made deals with those countries in which protests took place, but the U.S. benefited from those deals.
Well, you were here during that 12-day war. You showed me earlier how your window in this office was smashed. You showed me hunks of melted, molten metal that came from either missiles or some other weaponry, perhaps. So you felt it. What was it like? And how fearful are you that this could happen again, or maybe worse?
It is very likely. We have prepared ourselves for almost any situation. Anyway, at least mentally, the possibility exists. That war was a very bad one. We here in the office of Ensaf News thought for a few moments that there had been an explosion right here. The blast was very strong. Of course, only parts of the Iranian people felt this war. Many parts of the country did not feel this. The duration of this war was also short, only 12 days. It was a shock and a reminder for the people to be prepared. This event ended to the detriment of the U.S. and Israel because, in the minds of many people, the idea was set that Israel and the U.S. can totally disrupt the lives of Iranians, and they know no red lines in this regard. The number of people who wanted Iran's defense to be strengthened increased.
So, if the United States attacks you, do you feel like your government can defend you as a citizen of Iran adequately?
Anyway, the U.S. is a superpower militarily. Maybe it can even destroy us. The U.S. has a large number of nuclear warheads. So does Israel. So do those European countries and others. They can definitely do it. But we are not an easy opponent in spite of our size. Just like in the 12-day war. We were the only country that launched a missile attack on Israel. No matter how many missiles hit and how much damage they cause, we still managed to strike. We even targeted the American base. We at least had the courage to do this. This is why the rest of the countries in the region do not dare to do so. In my opinion, we can reach an agreement with the U.S. and reassure them that we will never harm anyone outside our borders. But in order to ensure our own security, we need a minimum of defensive tools.
So things could get ugly.
Yes, we are prepared for that. The Iranians have their finger on the trigger, so that if they are ever targeted, they will respond immediately, to the extent that we are able to. In my opinion, another effect that the 12-day war had was that a number of the other countries also felt the same way, that at any moment, Israel could endanger their security.
Do you feel that your defenses, which seemed adequate during the 12-day war, have been improved since the 12-day war?
We are much more prepared, although we were somewhat caught by surprise at that time. This time we will not be surprised again.
You're right.
We are certainly no less prepared now than we were then. We have certainly been thinking about other issues during this time, like how we are able to at least hinder our opponents.
Do you consider the United States or Americans your enemy? And what would you say to my fellow citizens, Americans, if you could send them a message?
No, the Iranians have never considered the Americans their enemy. For instance, in the surveys that have been conducted, both before, during, and after the 12-day war, it has been proven the Iranians did not have a very negative opinion of the U.S. But their opinion of Israel has always been negative. Of course, regarding the U.S., opinions about it declined to some extent during the 12-day war. Don't take the slogan, Death to America, too seriously. This slogan is about the hostile policies of governments. Anyway, some Iranians emigrate abroad, many of whom go to the U.S. Therefore, Iranians do not have a negative opinion of America at all.
Let me finish then with what I think is a fair analogy. Going back to the question of the economy and what the government is doing. The world, or the West, maybe better said, including the United States, used every castigatory measure it had and threw it at Russia, froze their assets, sanctions, tariffs, personal sanctions, business sanctions. They hit Russia with everything, just like they've hit Iran with everything. Russia has survived. Russia has actually even bolstered its economy. Russia has a higher GDP than almost every European country. If Russia could do it, why can't Iran do the same thing?
Well, Russia is a very large country, and its power is much greater than ours. But we've also been able to defend ourselves as much as possible. If you walk the streets of Tehran now, or go around the country, you will see that we are not that behind or underdeveloped. We have made progress in these decades when we were the target of very severe sanctions and have not remained at a level of zero. Of course, we are far behind. The sanctions have bothered us a lot. But anyway, we are alive and living. And now the Iranian people want to make progress. They want to get rid of these sanctions. One of the weaknesses that we face is in the media. It is as if the U.S. and Iran are only negotiating about the nuclear issue. No, we are negotiating for a release from sanctions. What we want is to lift the restrictions.
You made me think of something. I'm sorry I said that was the final question. Now I have another final question, but We live in a world where, in many ways, Iranians are suffering because the United States controls currency, controls banks, controls trade rules, controls almost everything. And when the United States chooses to weaponize those things, as it has done with your country, it's very difficult for your country to get itself out of a hole. I imagine you will welcome the day when we live in a world where there are different banking systems, different currencies, perhaps one where one country doesn't control all the countries. Is that something Iran is hoping to achieve? And how are you achieving it? I'll give you one example. The president of China, Mr. Xi, last week said they're already starting a system to use the yuan as the currency of the world through other BRICS countries. What is your reaction to that? And how important would that be to your country?
Well, this issue depends on the decision of big countries, such as Russia, India, Brazil, and the like, not just on Iran. We certainly welcome this, but we alone cannot have much influence on this issue. The best thing is that we can reach an agreement with the Americans and the Chinese and other countries, and Russia, so we can all live a better life together under the current conditions.
Do you have good relations right now with China, South Africa, India, Russia, Brazil, many of these global South countries?
We are a small country. Our economic relations are not so strong that China will fight with the United States because of us. Therefore, many times Russia, China, and other countries easily bypass us because of sanctions.
Yeah, but you would look to them as partners and as allies? Or do you look to China and Russia in particular as allies?
We look at them this way. They do not look at us as so essential. For instance, did China and Russia bother themselves to suffer for us in the 12-day war? What did they do? How much did they bother themselves or suffer for us? We consider them allies.
So you feel like you're on your own?
To a large extent. If we want to have an economic system parallel to the one managed by the West, that is an issue that will be determined by countries bigger than us.
Final question. Sorry. What about the Arab countries? And what about the Gulf states? Do you feel like they have your back, or are you disappointed?
They also felt threatened in the 12-day war. You can see this clearly on their faces. Not only them, but Turkey, Pakistan, Egypt, and others also realized that Israel does not observe any red lines because it also attacks countries that are far away from it and intends to control them. The 12-day war brought us much closer to our neighboring countries, and they were brought much closer to us. These current negotiations are the desire of all of these countries, not just ours.
So what I just heard you say is, correct me if I'm wrong, since the 12-day war, you have developed better relationships with many of your neighboring countries in the Arab communities, for example, and Pakistan as well.
This is our feeling that they need the togetherness of the countries of the region more now to take care of and maintain our security, not to be a threat to the security of Israel.
Some people think you defeated Israel in the 12-day war. Do you think other countries feel emboldened now because of your victory, in quotations?
Of course, in the 12-day war, the countries of the region also saw that Iran has power and is showing its might. So they have a different interpretation of Iran's position now. You can see this in what they whisper or what they say in private.
Mr. Shafian, thank you so much for your time. You've been so gracious.
Thank you so much.
I know you're a busy man.
I'm glad it was a good interview.
I know these are difficult times. And it's very kind of you to invite us here and share the perspective of both the government and the Iranian people. And I feel like you've been very open, very honest, very transparent, and you've allowed me to ask any question I wanted to ask.
I hope we will have a better world, God willing.
Thank you. Me too. Once again, thank you, sir. Those are the Alborz Mountains. They surround much of the city of Tehran. Who knew, right? I didn't know that there were mountains right off of Tehran. And this is why you have to come to these places. This is why you have to be here, to ask the questions, to get to know what's Tehran like. It's not just another name in a newscast. It's a real place with real people, with real problems. And we're here because we want to explain what this place is and who these people are. Tell us how we're doing. Let us know. I'd love to get your feedback. I'd love to get your comments. I'd love for you to share with us
what you think we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and what you think of this story. You can reach out to us, as you know, as many thousands of you already do, on X and on YouTube and on BitChute as well. Let us know. I'd like to hear from you. By the way, this is important. Reporting from Tehran, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for letting us into your homes. And we'll be looking for you next time.